This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The first season of The Bob Newhart Show, the classic CBS sitcom from 1972 to 78, has just come out on DVD. Newhart had another successful TV series, playing a Vermont innkeeper in the 1982 to 90 sitcom called Newhart. In his first and most successful situation comedy, though, Newhart played Dr. Bob Hartley, a psychologist with lots of funny patients and with a beautiful and funny wife, played by Suzanne Pleshette. Here's a scene from the first season in which Bob is in session with one of his patients.
I just feel so helpless because he's keeping everything to himself. It's like I wasn't even around. He hardly ever speaks to me. Just leaves and never even says where he's going. And if I even ask what time he'll be home, he just shrugs and says, I don't know, Dr. Hartley. I'm sure he has girlfriends, but he denies it.
Well, of course, Todd's 13 now.
I know he's growing up, but I just don't think he loves me.
Well, I'm sure he loves you, and one day he'll be secure enough to tell you. In the meantime, I just hold him a little more loosely. You know, if you let sleeping dogs lie, they'll never bite. I didn't mean that.
Before coming to TV, Newhart made his mark as a stand-up comic. His breakthrough album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, made him a star, even though Newhart himself complained to me once that listening to it drove him crazy. Apparently, the producer of the album made the engineer shorten all of Newhart's trademark pauses, which, to Newhart, ruined the timing completely. Other than Newhart himself, though, few people seemed to notice or care. His Button-Down Mind recording was the first comedy album to top the record charts. Terry Gross spoke to Bob Newhart in 1998.
Now, you're Catholic, and when you were coming of age as a comic, I think a lot of the comics were Jewish comics who were getting their start in the Catskill Mountains, which was a largely Jewish resort area. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that ethnic comics had a built-in constituency, i.e. people of their ethnic group. And did you feel like you had that kind of, you know, because there was no borscht belt for you.
No.
Did you play the borscht belt at all?
No, I never have.
Right.
The Catskills, no.
Right. So did you feel like that...
I played the Poconos. That's as close as I ever came to the
right.
Catskills.
Okay. Did you feel like you were missing out on something, not being identified as an ethnic comic?
Well, you know, humor, I think, at that time was very regional. As I recall, it was. I remember Phil Foster doing routines about the Brooklyn Dodgers, and then television came along, and you had to make your humor continental. You couldn't make it regional anymore. It had to be. You had to find ways of not making it regional. Is what I'm trying to say. After some time, I realized that a lot of my friends, a lot of the comics are Jewish that I know, and they would refer to their Jewishness, and then I began referring to my Catholicism and what it's like to grow up as a Catholic, and began to realize how funny it is in many ways to grow up. It gives you a chance to kind of stand back and look at it. And find the humor in it.
What did you find funny about your Catholic upbringing?
Well, for instance, I said what the difference between Catholics and other religions is basically we have confession, and non-Catholics don't understand how you go in this little dark room and tell another human being like terrible things you've done during the week. But if you're raised Catholic, There are certain tricks you learn about going to confession, like you sit in the very last pew and you watch the two lines move into the confessional, and whichever line moves the fastest, that's the one you get in, because that priest wants to get out of there. And I remember the first time I did that, and it got a big reaction from the audience, and I realized, oh, I'm not the only one who did that.
You kind of treat it as if it was a long line at the supermarket instead of, instead of the confessional. Can you remember for us what the venues?
You know, that's interesting because it does suggest they might have a confessional like, you know, 10 sins or less. You know,
the swift moving line.
I just thought of that.
That's good. Oh, you started doing stand up during the era I've come to think of as the "you dirty rat" era, because every stand up comic was compelled to do impersonations of James Cagney, and they also were required to do impersonations of Armstrong and Bogart, and you did some of those yourself.
I was never much of a impersonator. Comics kind of have an ear for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never real good at it. I found what was interesting, and it certainly wasn't planned in any way, but the people I mentioned, Mike and Elaine and Shelley Byrne and myself and Johnny Winters and Lenny Bruce, it was a different kind of comedy than had preceded it. What had preceded it was material that could be stolen. In other words, "Take My Wife, Please."
Jokes.
Or jokes. I burn a hole in the coat. I you like this jacket? It's a beautiful jacket. I got 8 pairs of pants with it. With my luck, I'll burn a hole in the coat. You know, well, anybody could deliver that line. It wasn't personalized at all. But without realizing it, because I certainly wasn't aware of it. Only in hindsight that I'm aware of it. You couldn't steal a Mike and Elaine routine or a Shelley Berman routine or a Bob Newhart routine or Johnny Winters routine. They would say, "Oh, that sounds like Johnny Winters," and so it became. It was just shift in American comedy that just happened, and I think why it happened was our audience was largely college. Kids and they didn't have mother-in-laws, so mother-in-law jokes didn't mean anything to
them.
Thank
goodness.
and so to that extent, the humor that was being done in nightclubs was irrelevant to them, and it was also very expensive. Nightclubs had a cover charge, and it was very expensive to go to a nightclub, and they didn't have the money, obviously. So they would buy a record. And get some pizza and some beer, and they'd all sit around and listen to one of us, and that was their nightclub, and I think that's what happened.
Right, and I mean, you had an onstage persona, like you said, it wasn't just jokes; it was a whole character that was telling these stories.
Exactly.
Bob Newhart is my guest. Let me ask you about the first sitcom that you did. The first Newhart show, you played a psychiatrist. It's common now to have stand-up comics with their own sitcoms. In fact, it's almost obligatory.
Right.
What was it like when you were a stand-up comic, having a sitcom built around you?
Well, it was paternalistic, really, because my manager, he and Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker formed. MTM Productions. And with the success of Mary's show, he came to me and he said, "Would you like to do a sitcom?" And I said, "Yeah, I would," because it would keep me home, it keep me off the road, and I could spend some time with the family, which was very important. So we then went about trying to come up with a sitcom. We started out with what occupation is he? First of all, he's married, right? Okay, he's married, and I insisted on that we not have children, that we not have precocious children, because I hated those kind of shows where the kids are always bailing the dumb father out of some scrape he's gotten himself into, you know. And we love you, Daddy. Daddy's an idiot, but we do love you. And resolved I wasn't going to do that kind of show. And so then we started looking for occupations, and sat down with Lorenzo Music and Dave Davis, who I had worked with before, who were, had been writers on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I knew Lorenzo from the Smothers Brothers show. And he said, well, you know, Bob is, he's a listener. He's a, like a reactor. He reacts to people. What occupation would lend itself to somebody who listens? And they said, well, how about a psychiatrist? So they came to me and said, what about a psychiatrist? I said, well, let's make him a psychologist, because I think a psychologist tends to deal with less severely disturbed people. And I didn't want to be making fun of severely disturbed people. I didn't want to be making fun of people with multiple personalities or schizophrenia or any
right.
of that stuff.
Suicidal depression, yes. right. just Mr. Carlin.
Mr. Carlin actually was worse at the end of 6 years than he was when he originally came to me. So he has a class action suit against me, I think, as do most of my group.
Bob Newhart speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bob Newhart. They were talking about his first TV sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show, season one of which is now available on DVD.
Now, part of your persona in The Newhart Show was, you know, he was the straight-laced, middle-of-the-road guy who was kind of dull.
Okay.
Right? How did the writers come up with that aspect of it? Surrounded by a lot of nutty, eccentric people, but he was kind of dull.
Well, part of the success of Newhart was we tried to isolate what made the Bob Newhart Show work. And what seemed to make part of the Bob Newhart Show, at least the working environment of the Bob Newhart Show, the psychologist's office, was you had to have a situation where no matter how outrageous the statement was made by one of the patients, you couldn't react to it. You couldn't say, "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard, Mr. Carlin." You know, you'd have to say, "I remember one time I said, how did this week go?" He said, "It went very well." He said, "Oh, Saturday I was possessed by the devil." and I think my line was, "Okay, you want to go with that, Mr. Carlin?" You know, I couldn't say you were what. So we tried to find those elements and. In Newhart, and we found them in the guests. No matter how unreasonable the guests were, you still had to kind of say, "Certainly, sir. Certainly, I'll send the maid up to the room right away."
Do you have a favorite episode from the first Newhart show?
I have several. There's one that kind of summed up comedy to me. I had an African-American insurance salesman came in, and he was very tall and muscular, and he wore the Djibouti, and he had a black Great Dane that he called Whitey. And he came to me, and he said, "I don't seem to be able to sell insurance policies." And I said, "Well, it has nothing to do with your personality. It's just that you kind of scare people, you know." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." So then we leave my office, and he said, "Is the men's room?" And I pointed out just down the hall, and he let the Great Dane stay there. So with that, Jerry comes out, and he comes over to me, and we start talking, and with the black gentleman comes back in, and he says, "Sit, Whitey." And with that, Jerry sits right on the reception desk, you know. And it got a huge laugh. And to me, it summed up what comedy does. It diffuses tensions in many areas. It gives you distance. so that you can stand back and laugh at things.
You know, your shows have been rerun a lot on Nick at Night, and I think there was one, I don't know, 24 or 48-hour period when they did a whole Bob-a-thon. They were bringing on, I guess, a new series of yours, a new and rerun series of yours, and to introduce it and celebrate it, there was just hour after hour of continuous Newhart programs. What was that like for you?
Well, that's a tribute to the cast and to the writing, that the writing is still valid. And I had something to do with that. I said, I told the writers, don't put any Gerald Ford jokes, you know, because this is going to be rerun and rerun and rerun, and we're going to look silly, you know. Because I knew then that it would go into syndication and people would be watching it, and we tried to get away from being trendy, and for that reason, and it holds up. The material holds up, which is largely a tribute to the writing.
The lapels and the sideburns don't hold up.
That's the only thing I know.
You wear a lot of plaid, also.
Oh yeah.
No, well, see, whose idea was all the plaid?
My dresser. My dresser was colored blind.
Are you kidding? His name was
Ralph. Yeah, and he was such a nice guy. We didn't want to say anything, but
oh, that's so Newhart.
My wife.
that's like quintessential Newhart.
My wife would come in, and I'd be ready to go out, and I'm not good with colors either. So she would say, "Oh my God, you're kidding." I said, "What?" She said, "Oh, take the jacket off. It doesn't even come close to going with the shirt."
That's funny.
But, you know, of all careers to choose when you're colorblind, I mean, wardrobe seems like the last one.
Yeah, you think somebody might have said something about it at the studio, or...
I remember reading an article in a paper about a one-eyed bullfighter in... again, we get back to the material coming out of the papers. A one-eyed bullfighter in Spain who was reapplying for license to fight the bulls, and it occurred to me then that if there is one occupation where you really want to have two good eyes, I think bullfighting would be right up toward the top, you know. I mean, of all professions to choose.
When I think of the Newhart character in your shows from the 60s, from the 70s and the 80s, I think of somebody who stammers a lot, not because he's unsure of what he feels, but because he can't really afford to reveal what he really feels, because it might be a little harsh or it might be a little too something. So there's this constant kind of like stammering to just, you know, cover up and to try to kind of package in a better way what it is that he's really thinking or feeling. Does that work for you?
Well, that's interesting, because the stammer is real. I didn't invent the stammer. I remember in the first year of Newhart, we were doing an episode, and it was running long. And one of the producers came up to me and said, "Can you run some of the words together? Because the show is really spreading." And I said, "Look, this stammer got me a home in Beverly Hills, and I'm not about to change it. So you better cut some words out of the script." No, it isn't. It isn't. An affectation. It's a way I speak. Although I do, I know what you're saying. It does help to get you over an uncomfortable moment. I mean, I think that I think of him as a nice person who doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, has difficulty saying, you know, what he means.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank
you very much.
Bob Newhart speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. The first season of his classic 1970s sitcom, The Bob Newhart Show, is now out on DVD. Coming up, a review of the new film, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.